All right. All right. Now I'm going to go back to. I'll do shoulders, Devonda shoulders, and I'll take up that succession of cases.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ross Neuhauser from the shoulders.
All right, let's see.
Good morning, Your Honor. Raphael Whitford, also.
Good morning. So, this is on the motion to extend time to complete financial management course. So that's been done, right?
It has.
Okay. And this one also... you had moved to extend time to pursue preference funds. Have you gotten any preference funds back?
We have not.
Okay. What's the status of that? What do you intend to do?
I guess I'll file an adversary proceeding. We haven't been able to come to a resolution with the attorney for the creditor. He seems to have a defense in this case.
Okay. So. All right. How long do you need to get that done?
14 days.
14 days. Okay. So I'll enter an order on that. And this is one of the cases that I sent out the order requesting information about how you were paid initially, how you acquired the case, your fee agreement with the debtor, and an amended disclosure and other amended schedules. That include a payment history, and it looks like now. You filed some things this morning, didn't you?
Not, I did not.
No,
we filed in the past 48 hours. We've been like 24 hours, Sunday and Monday, filing a lot of things.
Okay.
So Sunday and Monday is when the court will see all of those things filed.
Right. What? Yeah. When I looked at it yesterday, I didn't see there are three new documents in here. Okay. All right. The court's going to look at those, and there are some administrative issues that's been brought to the court's attention by the clerk that you're going to get. Probably going to get a deficiency notice, but then the court is going to take a look at that and take it under submission. And I'm going to, the U.S. Trustee's here, and I'm going to issue an order to the U.S. Trustee's office to begin an investigation based upon the information that's been filed. Mr. Goldberg and Mr. Steinich, have you been watching the court's order and what the court wants on these cases?
So we saw the court's order that was entered in the Shoulders case. We have not had a chance to review what was filed yet, but we will take a look at that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to issue a separate order on that because based on what I've looked at and what you have filed and the court's information and based upon the number of these cases, I can't tell if you understand the rules and are just not doing it the way it's supposed to be, or you do not understand the rules and so you're not doing it the way it should be. But it's an issue. You know, and the court has been taking it very seriously for about the last 90 days. And the manner in which you have undertaken or acquired these, the work from these debtors, these Chapter 7, in some of them Chapter 13 proceedings, the manner in which you've acquired it, the agreements that you have entered into with the debtors, the disclosures to the court, the payment arrangements, both pre- and post-petition, all causes court extreme concern because I've been doing it 30 years. This worked for 30 years, and what you all are doing, the manner of practice that you're doing, runs afoul of the bankruptcy code. For whatever reason you're doing that, it is a problem, and it needs to be addressed, and the U.S. Trustee must investigate this. It's not just about you making a living at this. It's about doing the right thing. You're licensed professionals, And so I have looked, I didn't see the last three things that you filed, and I won't bore the court or, you know, everybody in the courtroom on that. But it's this court's job to administer cases. I don't just have an adjudicatory function. I also have an administrative function. But the court has now completed pretty much its administrative function and now is convinced that the concerns under the bankruptcy code and the manner in which they're operating or their law practice, they're inconsistent and it needs an investigation. All right? So I'm going to give you 14 days to go ahead and file your AP. You need to, you're in the case until you're out of the case. Once you file a case, you are counsel of record until the court says otherwise. So that is what's going to happen on Devonda's shoulders. We're going to do an order giving you 14 days to file an AP or not. And if you don't, the case is still going to remain open for administrative purposes. But it would be a deadline for her for you to file this, whatever action you think is necessary to recover a preference. Now, we'll go on to Channel Lawson. On that case, you have a motion to extend time to pay filing fee installment.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, this looks like this case was filed in October. And the application was filed then. Has she paid it?
I believe it has been paid in full to the court at this time.
All right. Let's see. Brenda, can you see when that was paid? Okay.
January 13th.
Right. All right, January 13th. Okay, so the motion is remanded and terminated. And on this one, you have you responded to the court's order on their fee arrangement. There's the amended disclosure. There's the sealed document, which includes the routing numbers on the post-petition, pre- and post-petition. Have either of my colleagues brought it to your attention? What's the name of that case?
Davis,
out of Alabama.
Judge Stout mentioned that when I was in front of him for a motion to extend time, and I looked it up as soon as I went back to the office. I don't think that's relevant to our practice at all. And it concerns me that the court probably thinks otherwise.
Well,
I mean,
it's the only difference in that case and in your cases, there may be a few other differences, but pivotal is that in that instance, that lawyer was having his clients come in on at the initial consultation and sign post-dated checks and had those checks put in a self-addressed stamped envelope, and then the clients took their own checks, the envelope addressed and stamped that was addressed to the lawyer, they left, and then when the lawyer filed the case, he would notify his clients, and then they were to drop those checks in the mail. And those were post-dated checks, and those were used to pay. And that's actually a very serious case. And yours is the only difference. What you all are doing and what that lawyer was doing was you're using ACH transactions, automatic clearinghouse transactions. And that presents some pretty serious issues, I think. So you should pay close attention to Davis. This court is not going to reinvent the wheel. I don't have to. But when the judge ruled on Davis, he was applying the rules of this document, or set of documents, and it's not new. Everybody that practices in this court has to obey the same rules. Every lawyer has to obey the same rules. And it's one of the reasons, the problems that are related to what you all are doing in your practice gave rise to the protections against petition preparers. petition preparers take money from people and don't give them legal advice because they can't, and they frequently put their clients in positions worse off than when they walked in the door. And so, yeah, that's why we have that statute. It used to be we didn't have that statute, and the authority the court exercised to police things, these cases in its administrative capacity, would be under Section 105 and criminal statutes. Well, today, Congress has tried to address what they thought was covering the issue, but you all have law licenses, and you're doing things that are very similar to petition preparers. So it needs to be investigated. And the court can't be an advocate. The court simply has the responsibility to exercise its adjudicatory function and its administrative function. But this is where the U.S. trustee, if this fits squarely in your camp now, to police the bankruptcy code and the practice before this court.
We think that one of the big problems with the way Mr. Neuhauser and Mr. Whitford practice their cases is that one of the tools that the court has for the neediest of the needy debtors is the motion to pay the filing fee in installments or the motion to file in forma pauperis. Well, when the majority of your practice involves bringing in clients and taking approximately $260 of them to get the case filed, that doesn't cover the court's filing fee. So it presumes that in every one of those cases, an application to pay the filing fee in installments will be filed, or an informa pauperis application, which raises the issue of whether or not counsel, as officers of the court, are making that reasonable inquiry into whether or not their clients can afford to pay the filing fee. And if they're filing those motions in every single case, they might not be doing that. It puts a burden on the court to have to look at each one of those individually. And you know, in the past, there's always been a compact, if you will, between the court and the bar that those sorts of motions would be, you know, used sparingly and judiciously by the bar. Not what we've got going on here, where the court's, you know, leniency in granting those in the past is now being subverted as a marketing tool to bring in clients. Almost every one of them is going to get a motion to pay the filing fee in installments. Where's the reasonable inquiry into whether or not they can afford to pay the filing fee to begin with? I mean, a lot of that, you know, if that were being done, it might alleviate a lot of these motions. And also, you know, save the court a lot of time and aggravation, you know, having to decide each and every one of these motions individually.
Well, and you're certainly going to get your chance to see, because you're going to be filing something, because I'm going to enter an order requiring an investigation. But a couple of things, not just, I mean, what you've said is important, and I don't want to undermine any of that, because I would tend to agree. But there are a whole host of issues that you all have run afoul of, and I'll just throw a couple out because I don't know that I could be completely exhausted here because I haven't been making notes. But when a client comes into your office and acquires your services, retains your services to file a bankruptcy petition, you enter into some kind of a fee agreement. That is a pre-petition agreement. No matter what you say in there about what's going to happen post-petition, once you've agreed upon an amount of money, that is a fee agreement and it is pre-petition. And that makes you a creditor if it's not paid in full, which is why every other lawyer who ever practices bankruptcy gets their money up front. There are exceptions to that in Chapter 13, where by local practice we don't allow post-petition, there's pre-petition payment of fees. It's all paid through the Chapter 13's office. Chapter 11 practice, Chapter 9 practice, to the extent we really don't have it, but pretty much lawyers get retainers, but they have to put that in their escrow account. The case law on those levels of practice and the way that is managed is very well developed. Chapter 7 is different. Lawyers know in this district and pretty much every other district that I'm aware of, because I used to practice up and down the Eastern Seaboard, Chapter 7, you get your money up front. Or you don't get it at all, because the day they walk in and they acquire your services, that is a pre-petition contract in writing an agreement that says that you're going to get paid $700 after the petition for post-petition work doesn't work unless your disclosure is appropriate and it is truly related to post-petition work. Your 2016 Bs are defective. I've looked at the amended 2016 Bs are defective. But significantly, an agreement made with a Chapter 7 client in your office for filing a petition is a pre-petition agreement. And that, if it's not paid in full, the fee is not paid in full at the beginning, then you, what you have is an unsecured obligation the day you file the bankruptcy. And that disqualifies you under the bankruptcy code from representing your clients. And it's the conundrum that bankruptcy lawyers, is one of the reasons lots of lawyers don't come here. For good reasons. There are plenty of lawyers in this town who have been practicing forever, and they've come down here and they've gotten burnt financially because they didn't understand that the day they filed the petition, they had a conflict of interest because they were a creditor as well as the counsel for the debtor. That cannot be. Just because in Chapter 7 you don't file retention motions or fee motions doesn't mean that you don't have to obey the rules that everyone else has to obey. The rules apply to Chapter 7 lawyers as well as Chapter 11 lawyers. And so you cannot be a creditor and debtor's counsel. That is a conflict of interest. Second, or third, the ACH transactions are automatic devices created by your office to get a pre-petition unpaid legal fee, a claim paid post-petition. And when that is done during before discharge, my gut reaction is that you violated the automatic stay, just as any other unsecured credit, or excuse me, secured credit. The secured creditors come in, they get payments post-petition. In Chapter 13s or 7s, a lot of times they run in to get a stay order because they're afraid to apply the check. Because if you read the bankruptcy code, if you deposit, if you are a pre-petition creditor, and you deposit any money post-petition prior to discharge on account of a pre-petition claim, you're in technical violation of the automatic stay. And then you get into the 524 problem. Post-discharge, if you're receiving money on account of a pre-petition claim post-discharge, then you're in violation of the discharge injunction. The bankruptcy code allows debtors, as a matter of morality, you can always pay voluntarily. But the ACH transaction that is initiated on a pre-petition basis on account of a pre-petition claim for the use of payment post-petition during the 362 period and the 524 period gives rise to a violation of both the stay, the automatic stay, and the discharge injunction. There may be defenses to that, but the court's gut reaction is that not only are you instantly, the minute that petition is filed, in a conflict of interest with your clients, but you're also in a position of having to disgorge. And there are lawyers that come and call through this court that had to disgorge, and it is a severe penalty. There are creditors that have to disgorge. That is a huge problem that you have up there, and it needs to be investigated. The court is not in a position now to be an advocate, but it's the U.S. trustee's job to police the system, and the system demands that lawyers not be have a conflict of interest with their clients the second they file a case. That's a fact. The U.S. trustee would take a very severe look at other counsel who are in this courtroom and other courtrooms if it saw a lawyer having a conflict of interest with his clients literally the second it files its case.
Right. But I think it's important to keep in mind that these are not the only two lawyers in the Western District of Kentucky who receive fees post-petition in a Chapter 7 case.
Exactly. And the world is looking now. And it's, again, this court has an adjudicatory function, but it also has an administrative function. To the extent that the practice in this district has dissolved for whatever reason into a lawlessness, it needs to stop. And it's maybe not just them. I've got another lawyer I saw doing this the other day. I mean, he's coming in next week or the week after next. And if this is what's happening here beyond these two practitioners here, then it needs to stop. We're going to send a big message. When a lawyer takes a pre-petition fee and their client had sufficient money to file the filing fee, and the lawyer decides to put it into his operating account, there is a huge potential. In fact, I think that is a conflict of interest. But I'm going to give someone the benefit of the doubt to try and argue with the court on that one.
You know, I've given this a lot of thought, and so have other, you know, people in my office. What statute or rule is there that prevents an attorney from taking some or all of his fee before the court's filing fee is paid in full?
There won't be a statute, but there will be a rule of professional responsibility. You won't find a statute unless someone wants to enlighten me. If anyone wants to file an amicus brief on it, please have at it. I need to think about what would be a good deadline for that. But you see, the bankruptcy code, one of the things about it is because it has a unique set of fiduciary obligations, debtor's counsel has a fiduciary obligation not just to your client, but to the estate itself, which includes stakeholders in the estate. It's one of the areas, it's one of the reasons other lawyers want to stay the heck out of here. Because they get over here and you file a debtor case and all of a sudden you can't play fast and loose with the rights of others. You have to honor the highest and greatest duty known under the law. And so it's not like practicing in Jefferson Circuit Court when you maybe have a personal injury case and a lot of shenanigans go on in lawsuits and places where lawyers don't have a fiduciary duty to their opponents. They do here. And so it makes this practice, among other things, not only complex but unique in the responsibilities that you have. So we enforce niceness, good faith, fair dealing at the highest level. That's it, and the bankruptcy code assumes that everybody knows that. So that's why you're not going to find a rule that says thou shalt not do this. The KBA has rules that say that thou shalt not elevate your financial interest above your clients. Nobody is responsible. No lawyer must accept an engagement that they cannot afford to take. But once you accept that engagement, you must, under the KBA regulation or KBA rules, you must honor your commitment to your client to elevate their interest. So your fee agreement either takes care of you at the beginning, you get all your money up front, or you don't get it until the court says it in this court. So that's why you're not going to find a statute, a rule. You're going to find that the second a lawyer has an agreement to take a certain insufficient sum into his or her hands, and he decides whether to put that in his escrow account. See, that's what the escrow account's all about, right? I mean, let's all kind of relearn what we learned a long, long time ago. The escrow account is client money that's put in a very safe place, cannot be attached, right? Nobody can go issue an attachment on an escrow account. It's in a safe, segregated place. And it's only when that fee is earned, or the client's needs are taken care of, did you draw that out? I mean, I've started practicing law in my father's law firm, that seems like 100 years ago, and about the worst thing that could ever happen is anybody attempt to draw money out of the escrow account before it was time. So the decision that a lawyer makes about where client money goes from the very beginning, it goes at the heart of the fiduciary relationship a lawyer assumes for his client. Where does that money go? Does it immediately go in your operating account, which goes to pay your expenses? Or does it go into the escrow account where it is held safe until a decision is made? Now, what makes these sets of cases so tricky is these are people in financial distress. And so they have an X amount of money, which is insufficient by definition, to pay for what is necessary to get them the relief that they need. And when a lawyer decides that his needs in his operating account are more important than taking care of either the filing fee or whatever else might be necessary, there might be pre-bankruptcy counseling that suggests that $1,000 that the client has the ability to get hold, that might be enough to get them another 90 days without bankruptcy. There is an analysis here. The knee-jerk, I'm going to put it in my operating account and then sail into bankruptcy court where we just sort of grab whatever we can get a hold of, that's not being a lawyer. That's being a petition preparer. So these cases look like petition preparer cases to me because the analysis that a lawyer has to go through under professional rules of professional responsibility demands an analysis. Where does this money go? Does it go to your escrow account or does it go to your operating account? And everybody that's ever run a law practice or been involved with a law practice other than the instant issues we have here knows that that is a huge decision because your law license is on the line. And you know, Mr. Goldberg, you've been around a long time too. I mean, we've seen lawyers come and go from this court who made wrong decisions about where to put that money. In this court, they've decided to put money in the fee in the operating account and not in the escrow account when they made a big mistake. So these are serious issues, and to the extent that the practice in this district has dissolved to lawlessness, it's going to stop. I'm sending a message loud and clear. Now, that's certainly not an exhaustive list, but that's on the court's mind. So she's paid. Channel loss remanded and terminated. How about Shanita Carrasco?
Carrasco. She is actually here, Chapter 13 case. 155. Mrs. Carrasco was, she had lost her job back in April, was on unemployment for a while, went back to work in September, and then she was garnished a couple of times, filed a Chapter 13, and has been in this unfortunate cycle of being late on her rent since her case was filed. She's been trying to get caught up. She gave $155 to her office yesterday, I believe it was, for the filing fee. And is waiting on her taxes to get the rest of the filing fee paid to the court. She believes 3 or 4 weeks will be sufficient to get that done.
All right, and she's in a Chapter 13.
Correct.
So this is different. But, and this one got on my radar because I don't know how this started happening, but Chapter 13s should never get to confirmation if the filing fee hadn't been paid. It just shouldn't. By definition, I mean, it goes without saying that somebody who's going to pay, a wage earner who's going to pay over time, every creditor's been held at bay. You know, Chapter 13 is coercive to creditors. By its definition, it's coercive. And so if a debtor is going to utilize the power of this court to coerce creditors to hold themselves at bay for a 60-month period, debtor ought to have the money when she files a case. So 30 more days? Can you do that, Ms. Carrasco? 30 more days. Let's get that paid. You know, you're caught in a wrinkle. we're going to let you out of the wrinkle. You have 30 days, all right? But let this, another message to the bar. If the debtor doesn't have the filing fee, don't file the Chapter 13. And if you do, there better be a good reason for it because their plan's not going to get confirmed. It becomes nonsense when somebody wants to pay overtime to coerce creditors to let them keep their car or their house or whatever, that they don't have the filing fee. The chance of them succeeding is almost zero. But we're going to give Ms. Carrasco the opportunity, all right? I'll issue an order. How about Billy Lane?
We filed a motion to waive her filing fee. Mr. Wheatley filed an objection. Neither of them are here. I assume Mr. Wheatley is busy with 341 meetings.
What about the Lanes?
Billy Lane is not here. I spoke with her yesterday. I'm not quite sure why she is not present.
All right, well.
Would you like me to address Mr. Wheatley's objections, or are you going to deny the order because she's not here?
If it's in form of papyrus, and if you don't know why she's not here, well, I'm going to continue the hearing.
Okay.
In form of papyrus is, for whatever reason, in form of papyrus and these fee installments has become a knee-jerk reaction. It's a serious business. Somebody can't afford it, and the court signs them frequently after talking to debtors. If they're really in destitute circumstances, the court will take that into consideration, but they have to be here. It's like a reaffirmation. Some things are, well, everything in this court is serious. I don't want to undermine the seriousness, but we'll set a new hearing. How about March 10th? Let's, because I'm gonna enter an order requiring the U.S. trustee to do an investigation, and I'm gonna open the floor for amicus briefs. Because what I'm about to do, when I say we're gonna stop a dissolving ethical practice in this court, I want to make sure the lawyers and the practice here have an opportunity to weigh in on that, because it affects everybody, not just you guys. Okay, how about Dennis Green?
Dennis Green, his filing fee has also been paid in full according to our records at this point.
Okay, final installment. Okay, remanded and terminated. Tanya Chin.
Tanya Chin, we filed a motion to extend time because she was being garnished prior to her bankruptcy case being filed. And again, that's one of the reasons why we started filing a lot of installment fees were for the garnishment people. And I think we tried to help everybody in a method that might have not have been tailored enough or sufficiently tailored to practice to do in front of this court. But she was one of the ones we filed without receiving all the money up front. And her filing fee has been paid.
Okay. All right, so terminate, okay. Remanded and terminated. Amanda Pantoa?
Amanda Pantoa, her filing fee has been paid in full.
Was she also being gone for petition?
No, Your Honor.
So that hearing is remanded and terminated. And then Krisha Chester.
Ms. Chester, she was being garnished pre-petition. Her filing fee has now been paid in full.
So remanded and terminated. All right, you all have filed a brief, I know, in response to, I think it was the Lawson case.
It was three cases, Montgomery, Lawson, and Sherry Lewis.
Okay. All right. So the court is going to enter an order that requires the U.S. trustee to do an investigation based upon my oral statements today on those issues.
And we have seen and read that brief, Your Honor.
Okay. You've seen and read the brief. So
yes.
I'm going to give you the chance to, how long do you think you need to take a...
Judge, I really couldn't say at this point until I know the extent of the investigation we're going to need to do. Mm-hmm. A chance to go back to, once we see the order, to go back to, you know, the assistant U.S. trustee and figure all this out.
All right. 10 days, can you give the court a report on what you think is going to be, we'll just use the Lawson case, what is going to be necessary in terms of investigating this and making some kind of a report to the court in a more extensive fashion?
Yes. Do you want that filed in the Lawson case only?
You can file it in all of them, but I want to make sure that I get a copy in chambers so that I know what you're doing, okay? So a lot of these cases are getting ready to be closed, and the court doesn't want anything closed yet until this is looked at.
Yeah, we can file
10 days
a notice in the Lawson case.
All right.
Within 10 days.
All right. And is there any other counsel and law firm in this courtroom that seeks to file an amicus brief and have any idea when you might think that would be appropriate?
Your Honor, if I may, Chair Dean DeCroma, my colleagues and I were just discussing your direction that it be opened up to members of the bar, and we thought it may be appropriate to have Tracy Hirsch, who's the head of the LBA, circulate it for lawyers interested in filing an amicus brief in this case. So perhaps 30 days.
All right. So if I'm going to do an order for the U.S. trustee to within 10 days report to the court on what it thinks is necessary in terms of investigation, and it's beyond you all, to the extent that there's been a dissolution of what this court has articulated as what should be expected out of lawyers in this district, then it covers, it's just going to cover the practice before this court, okay?
Will you issue your order to our office today?
Probably. We'll have to figure out what it's going to say, but
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, and then I think what will happen is the court will then, once I get that report, then I'm going to issue an order giving the bar, and I'll circulate it, make sure that the LBA gets it, to file an amicus brief on. And it won't reference you guys. It's going to reference, because you're not the only ones. You all just are the ones that got the court's attention. There's so much of it going on. But open it up to the bar on this business of, and I'll be specific. I don't have to go into it now. You all understand. Taking less than the full agreed upon fee and costs at the inception of the case, and that way people can weigh in. Okay.
Your Honor.
It is not just you all, but you all are the big filers.
If I may speak about our practice or the recent changes, we have begun taking everything up front, including the filing fee and all attorney fees. I would really like to carve out something for people being garnished, if that's possible. Even if it means waiving a large portion of fees in order to represent them. I guess from a perspective of, and this isn't as much related to the bankruptcy code as my own internal moral compass, if someone's making a significant amount of money and they're getting so much of it taken such that they can't pay for attorney fees, it seems like there ought to be some way of facilitating. Now someone who's not making next to nothing and is being garnished, you know, perhaps we can proceed with an application in form of papyrus and just not take attorney fees. Someone who is making $40,000 a year but has no money because they're being garnished, I don't know how to handle that.
Well, and you're going to get your shot to file another brief,
okay,
and raise this issue, because truly, there are issues here that exceed just whether you put money in the operating account or the escrow account or the ACH transaction.
Right.
The court is aware that there is an issue that puts counsel in a position of having to decide whose interests go first, because you are dealing basically with poor people, okay, or people who are in trouble. But for anybody who's been paying attention or has run across it, the courts also has another initiative going in the Chapter 13 arena, and that is just my 5% rule. If someone has telecom, bundled or otherwise, expenses in excess of or 5% of their net income or in excess of that, then they got to tender an affidavit of medical or business necessity, and they're probably going to get a hearing. And if I don't agree with it, they're not getting confirmed. And because I actually am talking about the same issue, or they're actually joined. Of course, a lot of things are joined here. And this is the deal. It's possible you have an indigent client who's, and many of them are indigent, and they're working, the working poor, they're having their incomes, their wages garnished. But a lot of people that come through this court are making financial decisions. And when you're having a telecom service or a bundled set of phones, cable, to me, those are choices, unless proven otherwise. And so lots of times you're going to have clients come in here who really do have money. They choose not to spend it on what's important. They've decided that their entertainment is more important to them than their homes or their cars or food. And that is a misplaced priority. It is a culture-wide misplacement of priorities. And I've decided, having been on the bench now for 15 years, I'm taking it on. I'm going to take on a total cultural dissolution. What has happened when people have decided that their entertainment is more important to them than their home or their food, that they're feeding their families? You know what I mean? So back to the indigent client. You probably really do have plenty of indigent clients that walk in the door who don't have a cell phone, they don't have cable. They're basically in, you know, the most meager and cheapest housing they can find, and they're scraping up money for food. Those people are going to get my attention because they're truly indigent. But what you have most often anymore are people who are making cultural choices about how they spend their money. And that's going to fall on deaf ears over here, because I really do see indigent people who are suffering. They're completely different than the family making $40,000 a year that has a $200 a month entertainment bill for internet, which does not feed or clothe anyone or house anyone. So get ready for that. What is truly indigent? Because I'm looking. What's indigent? And what are our cultural priorities? They ought to be housing, food, necessary transportation, child care. Those things are important. So just so you know, it's not like I'm not listening to you. I am. I think there are people out there that are truly suffering, and they're going to get my attention in a positive way. But not families who cannot tell their 15-year-old sons and daughters that they just can't tell them that the judge won't let them have that smartphone. It's, you know, I can't hear that anymore without reacting to it. So I'm going to open up the floor. You are more than welcome. When the time comes, the 30-day period allowing the bar to weigh in, you're just like anybody else on that, in the sense that, yes, I agree, there are indigents out there, but don't expect the court to cut wealthy people, people who have discretionary income that they're spending on entertainment, not pay your legal fees and the filing fees up front.
Okay, that answers my question, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, so we'll work this afternoon on what those orders are going to say, but I'm going to try to make them make sense. And if they don't, you all know how to tell me they don't make sense. That's the goal. Okay?
Right. Your Honor, moving forward, if the court eventually rules that an attorney has to take everything up front before the case is filed, I don't know how to proceed from here on. I don't want to make any more problems that this isn't going to be finalized or fully addressed for a while. And during the pendency of these proceedings, should we start taking all the money up front and sending away the garnished clients, or what should we do?
Well, you know, that's a business decision on your part. But I will tell you this, that if you take a case up front, and your client is harmed by you taking a fee. I mean, it's a free world. This court, it can't go at and shackle you from taking new cases, but not yet. I don't really intend to do that, but what I want you to remember is that when you take a legal fee, you put it in your operating account, and then ultimately your client is harmed by not having their filing fee paid, or some harm comes to them through the bankruptcy, you are going to be liable for that, because that is an ethical problem you have. And like it goes back to the difference between the escrow and the operating account. The distinction between those two, I don't know what's going on in law schools, but I guess Grace Giesel needs a phone call from me, because the difference between the operating account and the escrow account, they're two different worlds. That's just, and you as a lawyer are charged, your license is on the line making a decision whether or not it goes in either the escrow account or the operating account. And so that's the problem you're going to reach anytime you have a client come in who has an insufficient amount of money to pay your full legal fee and the filing fee. You are put in an ethical dilemma, because at that point, whose interests are more important? And you can't answer that it's yours. You have to answer that as a licensed lawyer, that it's your client's. I mean, somebody want to disagree with me on that? I mean, that's why you're a licensed lawyer.
No, I agree with you there.
You're put in the very difficult position, and it must always mitigate towards the interest of your client, or you can't take the case. I'll guarantee you, lawyers all over this building today, you go around, and they'll tell you, yeah, I couldn't take that case because there was no way I could take it because I wasn't going to get paid enough. And then all of a sudden, how money comes and goes becomes a huge ethical dilemma if they do take the case. So I can't tell you how to practice yet, but stay tuned.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. And I actually never had Professor Giesel in law school, so
well,
she doesn't deserve a phone call.
Well, she's in charge of, I don't know who else keeps his PR over there, but the escrow account and the operating account get lawyers into trouble. I'll bet you if you were to call the KBA, which I'm sure nobody really wants to do, how many cases are, you know, lawyers pistol whipping their clients in the conference room? Almost never. It might happen, but it's not. What's happening is the lawyer is taking money from the client and they're putting it in their operating account, not their escrow account. It's maintenance of accounts that is the number one problem. I say that, I'm not an authority on it, but I'm pretty sure of it. I'd be willing to, you know, bet you on that one. All right?
Your Honor, thank you for your time. And
thank you.
If I have one more question.
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor. While we're here, I figure I might as well talk about it. The conflict of interest that potentially might arise if we do not get the full attorney fee up front. Let's say we were to take a case, we require the full filing fee of the $335 to be paid to our office before the case is filed. We go ahead and remit that to the court upon filing. We don't file any. This will reduce the applications to pay the filing fee in installment. And then to resolve the conflict of interest, we go ahead and revise the words in our retainer and 100% waive any claim we might have to any attorney's fees, whether or not the case is discharged or dismissed. That way, it's 100, I mean, we try to run an honor system and to make all the payments voluntary. And we've explicitly put in words saying your debts, you know, are going to be all wiped out, including attorney's fees. We hope you pay us.
Yeah. Well, see, we hope you pay us is the real problem there. You know, what you could do, you could run a clinic. And I can't tell you exactly what is going to happen in the future because it hadn't happened yet and the words changed the meaning of everything. But you could run a free clinic. You could run a petition preparer clinic. But at any point when you are a creditor of the debtor and you file the petition, you have a conflict of interest, and you shouldn't take the case at all. So if there is a promise of future payment, if you can, ACH transaction, You are a creditor. That's why whoever else is doing Chapter 7 work in this town, if they're doing what you're doing, then they're doing it wrong. But what they're doing, I can assure you, or they will feel the full weight of this court, is they're taking whatever they can get plus the filing fee, and it's like, don't ever mention what's owed that they can't pay. The fee is $500. The fee is $200. The fee is whatever it is. There is no pay me if you can, because you're dealing with vulnerable people who are going to try and take care of the person that's helping them. They're vulnerable. By and large, they're at a disadvantage on information and sophistication. And that business of pay me if you can in the future, especially accompanied by an ACH transaction, is coercion. That's what I believe it is. I think that's coercion. Because it takes the voluntary nature of whatever. You know, the whole business of voluntary payments in the future, you got to kind of understand where this all comes from. There are some religions out there where it is a shameful thing, and perhaps even what they might consider a sin or a mortal sin, if they don't pay their debts. They still go through bankruptcy, but part of the bankruptcy code is to deal with that problem. That it's not necessarily a problem, but it is a cultural and a religious thing where some religions just don't believe it. So they may go through bankruptcy, but they're going to pay in the future. The lawyer can't figure out how that's going to happen. The lawyer can't be involved in that, or you've got a conflict of interest. In fact, if you're even owed any money the day you file the petition, you can't take the case. It's as simple as that. So when you talk about revising your retainer agreement, you should keep in mind that you are conflicted out of the representation if the day you file the petition, you are owed money.
Is that a waivable conflict of interest? Does this court have any
insight into that? I'm going to let you file a brief on that, but
I'll do that.
I will tell you that it's been the subject of, am I completely out there, Ms. Newcomb? Y'all deal with this all the time.
Your Honor, that's,
it's like the $64,000 question, isn't it?
Certainly it is, and it's something that has gotten the bar talking, which is why I do think Your Honor is correct that the bar is interested in weighing in. I frankly don't know what the amicus briefs will look like. I think there will be some that wish they could practice in the same manner for the same reasons. But our firm has always practiced in the manner in which you described, which is you get money up front or you don't get it in a Chapter 7 case. Now, of course, if there's adversary proceedings and other things that come up, then you deal with those down the road. But those are true post-petition events that happen that you can't anticipate. You know the day that Chapter 7 client comes in that you're going to a 341, you're turning over documents to a trustee, there's lots of things that you know you're going to be doing in that case from the day they come in. So, Your Honor, we certainly take the position that it's not a waivable conflict.
Well, I think the case law would tend to indicate that it's not a waivable conflict. All right.
And Your Honor, I just want to say, until this does get resolved, we're not going to take any fees post-petition.
Right.
I mean, that's
not
going
to
happen.
If I were you, if I were to take these, I'd make sure I got it pre-petition.
Yeah, there's no way we're going to do that between now and any time that there's resolution.
But if there's anything owed post-petition, you're a creditor, and you got a problem.
Right, and we're not going to. Up to this point, what's happened has happened, but it's not. We're not going to extend that position.
You know, and Judge, most attorneys who take the full fee up front also make a conscious decision to take a certain number of cases pro bono, you know, and it balances out.
Right. Right. I mean, because I look at it, and I know who you're talking about. There are some of the bigger firms, some of the smaller firms, they decide they're going to take X number of cases pro bono so that, you know, we don't turn into New York or Los Angeles where huge amounts of practice are pro se. Debtors come in because they, you know, they don't do this in New York and Los Angeles. There's a huge pro se practice because lawyers won't get themselves into that problem. Those judges there, those places are my friends, and believe me, they take a dim view on lawyers coming in and doing what you're doing. And so they have huge pro se practices, which is a problem. That's a problem too. I mean, the court is well aware that that is a delicate balance, but the bankruptcy court really code isn't delicate at all about it. Okay. So anyway, good luck with it. Once I get with your report, then I'm going to issue an order to the bar on the issue. It doesn't reference you guys. Okay, it's going to be in general.
One last issue regarding the portion of your order to amend Schedule F. I believe we asked for an extension on that pending court order, but given our discussion here today, we have not amended Schedule F, but given our discussion here today, can we have till the end of the week to amend all our Schedule Fs?
I'll give you 14 days.
Okay, thank you.
I'm doing some business travel here soon, so 14 days.
Thank you, Judge.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you all.